People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. A few years back, Philip Seagram retired from a long career in the legal system, first as a criminal lawyer and then a judge here in BC. That's also him strumming the guitar you're hearing. It wasn't until after he retired that Seagram tried his hand at busking for the very first time. What started as a vague urge turned into a big project. He would cross Canada by car, going from Victoria to Halifax, stopping in different cities along the way, and busking. He did this in spring 2022, when the country was still under the last vestiges of pandemic-era restrictions. It wasn't long after Russia's invasion of Ukraine had begun. Seagram came up with a plan. He would have his guitar case open as he played. If people wanted to donate money, they could. If people were in need of money, they were free to take it from the case as well. Whatever was left over, he would donate to help people impacted by the war in Ukraine. He made up a big sign that he would take with him to tell people that plan, and he hit the road. Starting out in Victoria. Seagram says that across the country, he saw the trust of people, both those who wanted to give and those who needed to take. He's shared the story of how people reacted on the streets and in the subway stations of Canadian cities in a book called No Judgment. It's nominated for a nonfiction award in this year's BC and Yukon Book Prizes. Today on the program, I speak with Philip Seagram about stepping away from the bench and stepping in to a cross-country musical odyssey.
My name is Philip Seagram. I'm the author of No Judgment and Other Busking Stories, and I'm here with Joe Pugh.
And can you tell me about the very first time you remember going out and busking in public?
Yeah, I do remember it. I think I was staying at my mother's place for, you know, maybe 3 or 4 days. I just popped over from BC, and she lives in Toronto and big city. I had a few extra hours and I thought, why don't I try this thing that I've been thinking about for some time? And ripped up an old cardboard box, you know, wrote a few words on it, and then just headed out to, and I got on the subway and I don't know why I went up to Yonge and Eglinton. I just thought, well, there's a lot of pedestrians there. I want to be on a busy street. Found a spot. I started playing. And I remember the day really well because it was just miserable weather. It was in November. It was kind of driving sleet, really windy. I was super cold. I think I had cut off gloves for my fingers. I'm not sure. I just remember being really cold and people looking at me with kind of quizzical expressions on their faces, like, what is this guy doing? I remember it well.
And one of the things I really want to get into over the course of our conversation is sort of the idea of being perceived and being seen in public. And, you know, doing that is maybe already a problem. And then you throw in the fact that you're out there busking and performing music for people. What was that like the very first time you did it? To kind of, is one thing to say, okay, I'm going to have this romantic notion of I'm going to go out and perform music for people. But when you're there and you've got the guitar and it's time to strum the first chord or sing the first note, how do you push through whatever you're feeling at the time to do it?
Yeah, that's a great question. It probably varies from person to person. For me, I don't consider myself, a highly proficient, experienced musician. You know, I'm like a lot of people who loves music and wants to make music. And so we do what we can. I've had some musical experience before busking, but it was generally in kind of a like singing in choirs or playing with this band that I played with for a few years. I hadn't really done much on my own. And, I still felt, even in a band, I still felt some level of self-consciousness. So playing by myself, singing my own songs, which is what I do, songs that I had written, you know, was a fairly, you know, vulnerable feeling for me. And it still is whenever I perform. So, I mean, all you can do is just take that first step and start playing and, you know, try to listen to what you're doing and pay attention to what you're doing. If you can get into the music, that always helps. So you try and get into it, but you have this panorama all around you filled with distractions, people walking by and cars and buses and, you know, the hamburger place across the street. There's so much going on. You can't help but sort of look out on it. And I think after that, after you take that first step and you just start playing, it just gets better and better. And there's something about playing on the street, which is extremely liberating. There's a freedom to it. There's a freedom to the idea that only people that really want to listen have to listen. They're not captive. If they stop, great. If they listen as they're going by, great. But you're kind of also just sort of playing for yourself or playing for just the music itself. So you just sort of push it out there into this very busy, loud, noisy, chaotic space. At least that's the sort of busking I was doing, because as I was always in cities on busy streets. There is a vulnerability to it, but at the same time, I felt this great sense of freedom when I was busking as well.
And in your chronicle of this trip, of this journey where you're going across Canada and busking in different cities, you write about your decision to retire in the lead up to it. You had a career in the criminal justice system. You were working as a judge, and you shared that when you made that decision to retire and you told other people in the field, there was this kind of reaction. There was this like, really? Are you sure you're going to step away from all this? Can you tell me a bit about what that was like and what happened?
Yeah, I told as few people as I could, because I didn't want it to be a thing for too long. I think people were probably surprised that I chose to retire when I did. When I gave my notice, and I gave them lots of notice. I gave my boss sort of 7 months, I think it was, notice before leaving. So there was lots of time. You know, I'd been a judge for something over 5 years. And I think most judges are in it for longer than that. And so I think that the reaction that I got was some surprise. You know, we'd been through a good chunk of COVID by then, and I kind of got the feeling that some of the judges that contacted me when they heard about it, they completely understood why I was doing what I was doing without even asking. But some of them were genuinely puzzled. Some of them thought, well, yeah, there must be something wrong. Some asked if I was, you know, if I was okay, if I was well, thinking that, you know, I might have some medical condition. And some, you know, I remember getting some messages from judges expressing, I won't say envy, but expressing, you know, maybe a bit of admiration and a wanting to get to that place as well. So I had a whole spectrum of different reactions to what I was doing. Those 7 months from the date I gave notice until my last day of judging, those really dragged. I really wanted to get to it, but yeah, had to go through that, knowing that I was going to be leaving and just holding on until I got to that date.
Could you give me a little bit of a sense of what being a judge was like for you? You touch on it in the book a little bit, where you talk about the good parts of trying to come to a solution that kind of all the parties involved will think is fair. You talk about it being really difficult sometimes to not have the work follow you all throughout your life. Like, it's not something you can just turn off at 5 p.m. and go home and forget about. Like, what is being a judge like?
Well, I was a judge in the Provincial Court of British Columbia, which it involves hearing cases of all different kinds. You're hearing criminal cases. You're hearing family cases in which there are disputes involving children of separated parents. You're hearing child protection cases where the ministry has become involved in parents' lives and children's lives. We were hearing small claims cases where people are suing each other in civil court. So there's a whole spectrum of different types of cases. It's a really busy court. The lists are very busy, and there never seems to be quite enough time to fit everything that you've got scheduled done. And there are delays, which are unfortunate, but are the product of, you know, scarce resources and more cases and more complexity to the cases that we were hearing. So I guess the first thing is it's a lot of work. It involves, I think, a whole variety of different skills, not just sort of knowledge of the law. It requires the ability to really listen, and it requires the ability to communicate well, not just through the decisions that you write or the decisions that you read, but also just while you're in the process of being in court and dealing with the parties that are involved. Some of them have lawyers, some of them don't. Some of them are in extremely anxious state. Some of them are mad. Some of them are sad. Some of them are scared. So you have to be a good communicator for it. I think also, you know, one of the key skills is you have to be aware of yourself. You have to be self-aware and particularly aware of any biases that you might have. You have to make sure that you have all of the information that you need before you start thinking about what the answer to a solution is, or the answer to a conflict is, or a problem that you're working on. So there's a whole variety of skills, and it's an incredibly fascinating job. It's really, really interesting. Sometimes it's very sad. Sometimes it's frustrating, and sometimes it's extremely, extremely satisfying. Yeah, for me, I think that you've touched on, you know, the hardest part for me was being able to turn it off when I left the courthouse and, you know, get on with the other parts of my life. Because you're always working on cases that are continuing or ongoing cases. And for me anyway, the cases that were ongoing would stay with me, or if there was a decision I was working on, it would stay with me when I was out of court. And there would always be at least some part of my brain that was ticking away, thinking about this problem that I was working on. And there are deadlines too. So you're always working towards a date where you've got to come up with the answer. So challenging job, really satisfying, fascinating with all of the people that you see, so many stories constantly coming across your or through your courtroom every single day. So it's an incredible job, really.
I would imagine that work must give you quite the perspective on maybe what is going on in the community or the province that you're living in. We're talking as well about this journey that you took after you retire, where you're crossing Canada and you're busking on different communities. How did that perspective, or the perspective you got from doing that Cross Canada Odyssey, how did that perspective kind of mesh with what you saw when you were a judge?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I was a criminal lawyer for decades in different parts of the province before becoming a judge. So I'd been in court for a long time, and I think that, you know, those of us who are in court through our careers, we're constantly, I think, trying to rebalance ourselves, and we're reminding ourselves that, you know, we're not seeing all of society. We are seeing, you know, most people never end up in court, you know, most people never actually end up in a courthouse. The lawyers and the judges, we're there all the time. And so I guess there's a tendency, when that's all you see, to think that it's representative of you know, the community that you live in generally. And it's not. It's representative of a small slice of the community that you live in. So, you know, lawyers and judges really don't know everything. And one of the things that I was surprised with when I left judging and was able to sort of expand my sphere and you know, get into a nonprofit situation and learn about how nonprofits work. Or, for example, I took a job in the winters teaching kids how to cross-country ski. So I was seeing sort of different areas of life, parts of the community that never intersect with the courtroom. And I realized how little I knew about certain, you know, areas of our community. So, you know, going across the country and having those experiences on the street, I wasn't really surprised too surprised by anything that happened or by anything that I saw. You know, what was most interesting to me was how people reacted to me and what the experience of playing music on the street was like for me, and how people responded to kind of the situation that I had set up, where I was telling people they could leave money, but they could also take money, and that anything left over from what was given at the end of the day was going to be donated to the Ukrainian humanitarian relief fund that the Red Cross had set up. So that was really interesting to me, and that involved, you know, surprises here and there that I found really fascinating and at times really, really moving.
Well, could you tell me about what some of that response was? So as you mentioned there, you go out, you're busking, you've got this sign that says you can leave money, you can take money if you need it, whatever's left in the case after you're going to donate to relief for people involved in the war in Ukraine. What was the response across different Canadian cities to you being out there busking?
No surprise here. A lot of people just walk by buskers. They don't, at least outwardly, respond. They may, they probably will sneak a look at the sign that you've made because they're curious. But a lot of people, you know, are just walking by. They don't have time, or they don't have the interest, or maybe they don't like your music. But a lot of people did react. A lot of people left money, and, you know, I had elderly women fishing into their little change purses and dropping nickels and dimes and pennies. And I had, you know, I had somebody drop a $50 bill into my hand. And I had a kid in the metro station in Montreal digging in his backpack and throwing a granola bar in. I had people that wanted to talk, you know, and that's one thing that, you know, I think kind of compelled me to really start paying attention and writing down some of the things that were happening on the street, was the conversations I had, because there were people that wanted to talk. I think the busker presented, you know, a really kind of safe opportunity for those people. People, it was kind of an opening, maybe the music, or maybe it was the sign, I don't know, but people, a lot of people would hang around and then they would want to talk. I found that, you know, eventually I understood that the location was really, really important. If I wanted to set up in a place where, you know, there would be people who would be willing to leave money, but also people who might have a need for the money and might be courageous enough to take money from the case, I would really have to pick the right spot. Where there was that cross section of people? You know, once I learned that, I did find there were people that were coming in and taking money out of the case. And, you know, one of the things that really surprised me was how incredibly honorable people were in the way that they would take money. They would always confirm that it was okay to take. They wouldn't just take the sign at face value. They would ask me, is it okay for me to take money? Or they would say, you know, can I have $4? And that's the thing. They were, almost without exception, really specific. You know, there could be $40 in the case, but they would say, I need $3, or I need $3.50, or would it be okay if I took $5? They were really, really specific, and they were really honorable in the way that they treated it. And there's one story in the book that I wrote about this woman who actually left change. She made change in the case and fished in her own pocket to put some money in, so she could only take exactly what she needed. So I was really, really taken by that.
What did you take away from that experience of people almost asking double permission or even making some change and trying to take only what they needed?
I guess a couple of things. One is just, you know, the even people that were in need and people that were, you know, at a low point, having tough times then, they still maintained that real sense of honor and gratitude and didn't see it as an opportunity to just take everything that they possibly could. So I think it was just the respect and the honor for the process. I don't know whether, you know, I don't know whether the music or just the setup was what was a part of that. I'm not sure. I just saw it just, most of the time, I just saw it as, you know, that there's a basic decency in everybody, no matter what situation they happened to be in, and there was a trust. I also, you know, took from it in hindsight, as I was thinking about it, I realized that it's a really big deal for someone to come and take money. And I had underestimated that. I hadn't even thought of it when I started out. I thought, well, of course, if somebody needs money, they're going to come and take it. But in hindsight, I really realized that it's a lot for someone to step up in public, reach into somebody's guitar case and take money from it. That takes a lot of courage. There were people that I saw, I could tell they were thinking about taking money, but they didn't. So I realized that that was a lot. And in hindsight, I would have worded the sign a little bit differently. I would have made it a little bit warmer in the wording. And somebody suggested to me at a talk that I was giving about the book that, you know, maybe I should have had the money in something a little more generic, like not in my own guitar case, but had just like, you know, a Tupperware container or just, you know, a bucket or just something that wasn't personal. And maybe that would have made it a little easier for people to come and take money, because I realize now that it does take a little bit of courage to come up and do that. And it takes some trust. And, you know, that's ultimately kind of one of the themes that I realized kind of ran through the stories that I wrote that became the book, was that there's a lot of trust out there being extended by people coming forward and taking the money that they needed from the case.
As we're talking about the story of you going across Canada in different towns and busking with this kind of take a penny, leave a penny idea, you mentioned that you were performing mostly your own songs. Is there any one song in particular you might want to share with people to give them an idea of some of what you might have been playing?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's funny. When I set out on the trip, I thought, oh, I'll have all this time to write music. And I didn't. It just didn't work out that way. But there were a couple of ideas that I wrote down, which later became songs. When I got back, I wrote a couple of songs that stemmed from the trip. You know, one of them is a song called Where the Freeway Ends. That was kind of inspired by a sign by the side of the highway coming out of Vancouver. And then there was another song I wrote after getting back, which is called Hello Hannah. And in that, I actually, there's lyrics and there's kind of a theme of about busking and traveling across the country and seeing these little towns that you don't have the time to stop in, but you're really curious about. And if you had the time, you'd stop and check out these little towns. So yeah, that song, Hello Hannah, is one of those.
Here is Philip Seagram's song, Hello Hannah.
Hello Hannah, I could use a break. There's 7,000 miles of highway trailing in my wake. I see your exit beckoning like fate. Hey Hannah, hello. Hello Hannah, you're the home of Nickelback. I read it on your welcome sign, but I'm sure there's more to you than that for a busker like this one heading west into the sun. Hey Hannah, hello. Hello Hannah, I could use some company. Not the kind requiring talk, the kind that lets you be in the corner of a cafe, putting words to all you see. Hey Hannah, all I've seen. It's another road song telling of the endless sky. How a child will stop for music every single time. Of the place you stayed in Moncton, where you locked yourself outside. It's a love song to the world rushing by. Hello, Hannah, I hope that you don't mind. I rolled on past your turnoff. I don't know why, I guess I missed my home or this old road. Maybe they are one. Hey, Hannah, so long. Hey, Hannah, so long. It's another road song telling of the endless sky. How a child will stop in wonder every single time of the place you stayed in Moncton when you locked yourself outside. It's a love song to the world rushing by. It's a love song to the world rushing by.
Hello, Hannah, from Philip Seagram. You're listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Philip Seagram lives in Nelson, and he wrote that song after going on a cross-Canada busking tour. While he performed in different communities, Seagram had a sign that invited people to leave money in his guitar case or to take money out of his guitar case. Whatever was left over, he would donate to relief efforts linked to the war in Ukraine. Not that long before he went on this trip, Seagram retired from his career in the legal system that had seen him work as a criminal lawyer and later a judge in BC. Seagram wrote a book about some of the stories that emerged from his busking tour. That book is called No Judgment. It's currently nominated for the Hubert Evans Nonfiction Prize in this year's BC and Yukon Book Prizes. So far today on the program, I've been speaking with Philip Seagram about his musical journey across the country. I'm also curious about, maybe this is the person who's worried about rules in me, but I'm curious about what are the different rules and regulations around where you can busk and how do they change from place to place in Canada?
Yeah, I was worried about that too. I think just given my background, you know, I was probably worried about it to the point of paranoia. So I actually did some research. I was not really well prepared for the trip. You know, I didn't do a lot of planning, but that was one of the things I did do is I checked out what are the laws around busking and street entertaining. And the answer is they're different everywhere you go. Some of them are extremely detailed and organized. There's, you know, lengthy bylaws, and other cities there's nothing. You can busk in Victoria, for example, but you've got to get a permit, you've got to pay for it, go down, you've got to check in, you identify yourself, you get a special number as a street entertainer. Calgary, I remember you had to identify yourself, but you didn't have to pay anything, there was no fee for it. Vancouver, you could only busk in certain places. They were really careful about that. Oh, Montreal was great because there was an app that you downloaded and then you could book these places in the metro for 2 hours and it wouldn't cost you anything. And you'd have this place in the metro, in a metro station somewhere for 2 hours, but it was free. So you didn't have to pay anything for that. So it was different everywhere. And if I got to a place, and there was a couple of places in the Maritimes, by then, you know, I hadn't done the research or I just didn't know. So I generally go into a shop downtown or just ask on the street. I'd say, you know, can you busk here? And I just learned that way. So bottom line, it's different all over the place.
I want to return to this feeling of being perceived or being seen in public. You mentioned that there was a kid who saw you busking and saw your kind of leave or take something tray and came to you with a granola bar. In your book, there are a number of other stories of how young people reacted to what you were doing. And I'm wondering if you could tell me maybe about that theme of if you saw a difference in how you were perceived doing what you were doing by kids and teens and youth compared to adults.
I think there is. I mean, I think there is, you know, the way people respond to music, forget about the sign and the give and take and the, you know, the charitable aspect of it. I think people react to music differently. I mean, I would play and I'd see kids, really young kids being sort of pulled along by their parents, and the kids wanted to stay and watch. They're fascinated by what's going on. And they want to dance, they want to move, you know, and the parents are kind of like, well, let's get going, let's keep moving here kind of thing. So the kids were, by and large, really, really into it. Yeah, there was a group of young women like walking down the street together when I was busking in Kingston. I do remember them, and I think I mentioned them in the book. And they were like this usual group of young teenagers. They're just talking away and interacting, and one of them noticed the sign, and she left money, and then the others noticed what she was noticing, and they all wanted to leave money too. And they just sort of bought into this idea of, you know, kind of paying it forward, of just understanding how lucky some people are and how unlucky other people are. They just wanted to be part of it. And that was what I got from that kid in Montreal who dug out the granola bar. He didn't have any cash. And that's the thing that I didn't realize, is how few people carry cash these days. I remember another guy who, I could see him going to a cash machine to withdraw cash so that he could leave something. And I found that really moving, that he would actually go to the trouble to do that. Some people would see the sign, would see the intent behind the sign, and immediately they wanted to be a part of that. They wanted to be a part of that process. Others were really curious about it. But you know, again, I speak of like, you know, these elderly women coming out of, you know, the pharmacy and reading it and just buying into it. So you get the whole spectrum. I don't know whether there was any difference between people. Ultimately, I couldn't say. I know musicians, I can tell when people are musicians and they stop and listen. Because of the way they listen, I can see them looking at your fingers, or I can see there's something about the way musicians were listening to it. And they would sometimes want to stop and ask a question about my guitar, or ask who had written the song, that sort of thing. So I can generally tell how, you know, if it was a musician reacting to it. But other than that, no, I mean, there's busy people, you know, the young men in nice blue suits that were, you know, on their way to a meeting, they generally paid no attention whatsoever, you know, but that's such a generalization. I mean, I had cops giving me a thumbs up and stopping and wanting to talk. So, yeah, just boiled down to the individual generally.
And on the theme of being perceived and maybe judgment, I understand that you had some feelings about the song Wagon Wheel, and that those feelings have evolved thanks to your trip. And I'm wondering if you could tell me a bit about that.
Oh, that's a really good perception. Yeah. As I said, I was singing mainly my own songs, but I did have a few cover songs that I took with me. You know, Wagon Wheel is a song that everybody knows. Everybody's heard that song. It's a very catchy song. I think I saw something on YouTube describing it as like the ultimate campfire song, because it's simple. Everybody knows it. It's got a great hook. There's a lot of people cover that song. I decided that I wouldn't learn it or cover it or take it with me to perform, because just to me it seemed too corny. It seemed too cliched to cover it. You know, here's another cover of Wagon Wheel. So I never really tried to learn it, although obviously I knew the music to it, because everybody does. And that was actually one of my favorite interactions in the whole trip, was that couple that stopped and the fellow asked me if I knew the song, and I tried to sort of get out of playing it or being a part of it, and said, no, I don't really know the words or anything. And you know, that didn't work, because he just said, well, I'll sing it. And away we went. And yeah, good point. No judgment. I had definitely judged that song, but that was such a nice little interaction with that couple jointly creating that song. And I actually have played that song since then and sung it. And I hadn't realized that the words are, it's actually a difficult song to sing because of the cadence of the words. So yeah, that was one on me right there is, you know, that little incident, you know, teaching me about really maybe not giving up on every song just because it's popular.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. My guest is Philip Seagram. In 2022, he went on a cross-Canada busking tour after retiring from a career in the legal system that had him working as a criminal lawyer and then later a judge. Stories from his cross-Canada tour have turned into a book called No Judgment. I've been speaking with Seagram about his experiences crossing the country, trying his hand at busking. I'm wondering, what did going on this journey overall, what did it teach you maybe about Canada and the nation?
I hadn't seen a lot of the places that I went to, and that was, I think, one of the reasons for wanting to do the trip. I hadn't seen Winnipeg, you know, and I was interested in music, and I knew so many of the bands and the great Canadian musicians that started off in Winnipeg. But I hadn't been to Saskatoon or Charlottetown or Fredericton, any of these places. You know, it was a strange time to travel across the country. It was right at the tail end of COVID, kind of the spring of 2022. And there were still a lot of restrictions, COVID restrictions in place. I was wearing a mask when I was busking in the metro in Montreal. So it was a strange time, and I didn't really know what to expect as I crossed the country and played in these places. I always knew that I was in Canada, and I can't say exactly why, but I always knew, despite, you know, the city looking different, or I always knew that I was in Canada. There's something common that is uniquely Canadian. Maybe it is just being super polite. I'm not sure. I think there's a humility maybe to, you know, Canadians generally that you know, I really appreciate. So, you know, that was one of the things that I noticed. I had thought before starting out that I was going to get kind of swallowed up in the country, that it was going to seem so vast and so huge. And, you know, maybe during the trip, because for long stretches of time, I was sort of completely isolated. I'd go, you know, hours and hours and hours without talking to someone, or I was driving long distances and just kind of being in my own head. I had thought that, you know, this would seem like a really, really long way from coast to coast. But just the very fact that I could get in my little car and start in Victoria and end in Halifax and then, you know, drive back, and, you know, just fill the tank once a day and go from place to place. It just, for some reason, I felt the whole country was a lot smaller by the end of it. I mean, you can drive from one end to the other and drive back. And, you know, for me, it was spread out over, you know, quite a period of time because I was stopping and spending a few days in different places and busking. And I visited with my mother for about 4 days, I think, on my way through Toronto. And, spent a few days in Calgary visiting people, and it just seemed a lot smaller than I thought it would be. The stretch between Winnipeg and Thunder Bay seemed awfully long, but, you know, other than that, it just, you can do it, and you're sitting there in your car and you're watching the whole country pass by, and you get through it and you get to the other side. And not sure what it was, but it just didn't seem to be this vast place. It just felt a little smaller. And I mean, I'm just doing a line between two points. So I'm not saying, you know, anything more than really what's on the side of the road or what's in these cities. But yeah, I just felt like, I guess I felt maybe a little bit more connected to these places. And because I'd seen them, they were real. They were concrete places. And maybe that kind of filled it in for me.
And one of the first places you visited is where I am speaking to you from now, Nanaimo. You shared an anecdote about how you talked with a local icon, someone who's going to be one of the headliners at a local music festival, Sunk City, this weekend, Willie Thrasher. What was that like?
That was great. I mean, this was my second place playing. I'd played in Victoria, busked there, and then went up to Nanaimo. And the weather on the West Coast is so nice compared to the rest of the country in early April. So yeah, Nanaimo was one of the few places where I actually saw a couple of buskers on the waterfront there. And one of them was Willie, and I didn't know anything about him. He was just the guy playing his heart out, as he usually does, you know, on the seawall. But I didn't know him. And I stopped to talk with him, and we had this chat, and, you know, and then I started busking, and he listened to me for a bit where I had set up, and then off he went. I didn't really think about it. You know, I just thought, oh, here's this nice guy that I'd met. I knew that he'd been to Nelson. Didn't know much more about him until, you know, as I write in the book, I'm driving across Northern Ontario, and I hear his voice on CBC radio, and I recognize the voice, but I had to wait for the interviewer to identify him, or maybe it was what he was talking about. But suddenly I realized, well, this is the guy that I had met just weeks before. Then I really got interested in his history, and it was great. When I decided that I was going to try and get what I'd written about the trip published, and I had the publisher was interested in publishing the book, I got in touch with Willie, and because I wanted him to see what I'd written about meeting him, and so I had a nice few telephone conversations with him, and I ended up sending him a draft copy of the chapter, and we talked about it a little bit.
What was the journey towards taking this story, this journey that you went on, and turning it into a book? Was it something that you ever thought about at all while you were doing it? And when you pitched it, what was the response like?
I never thought that I would be writing a book about it. About the trip. I do journal, intermittently through probably for the last 25, 30 years, I've journaled. And most of the journaling I do is just kind of a mind flush. It's just automatic writing where I'm just writing whatever is coming into my head. And sometimes, you know, depending on where I'm writing, I'll just write about what I'm seeing and just record something that I see in my book. But without it ever any intention of it being published or even read by anybody other than myself. And actually, I hardly ever go back and read what I've journaled. And I decided at the suggestion of a friend that I was going to journal during the trip because I thought it would be something. Yeah, I thought it would be a worthwhile thing to do. So I did journal during the trip and wrote down a lot of what I was seeing and doing and feeling. And, it was just a series of really lucky, I guess, lucky influences or lucky things that happened after I got back from the trip. My partner told me that, you know, she'd seen that there was a writing workshop being given by a couple of local authors here in Nelson. And she knew that I had always thought about, wouldn't it be cool to write and to write something other than, you know, legal decisions and legal briefs, wouldn't it, you know? And she knew I had an interest in it. So she pushed me a bit and I got into this writing workshop. And, eventually through that workshop and a writing group that evolved out of that, I started writing stories based on what I'd written in my journals during the trip. And then at some point in that process, I realized that, you know, maybe these stories about incidents on the street could be strung together. Maybe they're more like chapters in a larger story than individual stories on their own. So I started looking at the trip as a whole, as opposed to just these individual things that happened on the street, and kind of tried to string them together and put a beginning to it and an end to it. And I showed what I had to one of the authors who had put on this writing workshop, and just to get some feedback. And it was her suggestion that I try and get it published. So I did. I sent something into a publisher, and you know, didn't wait by the phone or anything. And I got an email saying, give us a call, let's talk. So incredibly lucky.
Hearing you talk about sharing your writing has also made me wonder about the idea of sharing music in the context of being a busker, or in any context at all, really, and how your journey of busking in different cities has changed, if at all, your perspective on, like, when you're playing music. You could be sitting in your basement with a guitar playing a song for just yourself, or playing a song for your friends at a party or something, or around a campfire, or you could be playing at a concert where people have presumably know you're going to be on stage and have shown up and they're going to listen to you. Or you could be doing what you were doing, which is going out in public and playing on the street or by a subway station. How do you think about the relationship between the performer and the listener and the place that the music is happening and the song that is being played? I'm curious about how all of your views on that have been shaped and influenced by this cross-Canada odyssey.
Yeah, I think that every performance is different. And I think that's the beauty of live music, because the setting makes a difference. You know, you could be at an outdoor event and the weather makes a difference. The people that are there make a difference. Your own headspace when you're performing makes a difference. So live performance is really special. You know, the busking, I think it did make me think a lot about what happens when somebody puts out their music and what that relationship is like between the performer and the person who's listening to it. And, you know, you hear about musicians, you hear musicians talk about this energy that goes both ways in a performance, that it gets sent out by the performer and then something comes back sometimes, not always, but something comes back, and then it becomes this kind of symbiotic experience where both sides are in the music. Both sides are having this experience at the same time of what the music is conveying. And it's not really about the musician. It's not really about the audience. It's not about how much the tickets were. It's just about the emotion in the song. It's about the feeling or what the song is trying to get at, which, you know, and that's kind of the magic spot. That's the sweet spot. And I think that that's what, you know, it motivates people to go out and see live music. It's something that only happens, I think, with live music. The thing about busking, I think, that was really interesting was there were times where, you know, I would literally be busking to an empty street or busking to traffic that was going by. And there was something really interesting about that, about just sending it out there. And it was a little different than, you know, playing in my music room here. It was just kind of, I guess it was public. You're more vulnerable. You're exposed to at least people seeing you. But there was that sense of creation just for the sake of the creation, just for the sake of making something, wherever it falls, that's where it falls. It's like, I'm thinking about that song by Joni Mitchell called Real Good for Free, where, you know, in the song, she's talking about being escorted to these massive concerts, playing for important people who've paid a lot of money. And on the way there, you know, she sees somebody just out on the street playing, and there's this wistful kind of sense of envy of that person just playing for the purity and the sake of playing, and it not having anything to do with making a living or a career or fame or riches. It's just the joy of creation itself. So that was a sense I got from busking, and that's kind of linked to that sense of freedom that I was talking about, that I experienced the first time that I busked, and which exists, you know, when you busk. I didn't know about that before.
Is that what you were thinking about when you were out there playing? You were kind of approaching it from this, like, joy of creation. You kind of let go of any expectations of what would happen to the music or how it would be perceived. You were just sort of putting your all into doing it and happy to do that.
Ideally, that's what you're doing. And ideally, you're enjoying it. Like, you're enjoying the music. not because of your own proficiency, but just because there's something in the music that moves you. So, I mean, that's the ideal. It's not always like that. Sometimes you're just freezing your ass off and you're hungry, or, you know, you're tired, or you're wondering, why isn't anybody stopping? But there are those moments where you just get focused on the music. You just get taken up in the music. And yeah, those are great. Those are awesome times.
Is there anything else you would like to highlight for people about your journey across Canada busking, or any of maybe the takeaways from that story?
I think, yeah, maybe. I mean, the only thing that I can think of is if you have an urge to do something, even if you can't even articulate why you have that urge, or why you're thinking it's something that you'd like to do, have a shot at it. Like, do it and do it when you can. And, you know, you may crash and burn, or it may end up being a really meaningful experience. I had no idea what to expect when I set out on the trip. I didn't even know really why I wanted to do it. I just felt this urge to do it. And I could rationalize it at the time. Somebody had asked me then, before I started out, why are you doing this? I could come up with a bunch of reasons. But I don't think I really understood at that time why I was doing it. I just felt this is something, for some reason, that this doing something like this is really pulling me. Yeah, maybe I would leave people with that, is that if you're feeling something like that, if you're feeling something pulling you, even if you can't truly articulate exactly why you want to do it, give it a shot. There's obviously something there that you need. So go for it.
Philip Seagram, thank you very much for taking the time to share a bit about the story with me.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure talking with you, Joe. Thanks.
Philip Seagram lives in Nelson, BC. He was speaking with me about his journey busking his way across Canada. He's also told that story in a book called No Judgment. It's up for a nonfiction award in this year's BC and Yukon Book Prizes. During our conversation, Seagram said he was reminded of the Joni Mitchell song, For Free. Here is that song off her album, Ladies of the Canyon. Curtain call.
the one-man band by the Quicklunch stand. He was playing real good for free. They knew he had never been on their TV, so they passed his music
from Joni Mitchell. That's all the time we have for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.